Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Rob, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Children as Caregivers for a Loved One with Cancer. And today's program is supported by ISI Inc. and Pfizer, and I really want to thank them for their support of this really important program. It's one that we have not offered this program before, and we're delighted to be able to offer this program with such esteemed faculty on the program as well. We have over 189 participants on today's program, and you come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Egypt, New Zealand, the Philippines, and the United Kingdom. So it's truly a global call. And it's a credit to each of you who have chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Jenny Hogg. And Dr. Hogg is Associate Professor of Pediatrics, Medical College of Wisconsin, Pediatric Psychologist, MACC Fund Center for Cancer and Blood Disorders, Children's Wisconsin. Dr. Hogg will be addressing definition of caregiver of a caregiver, what research tells us about children as caregivers' well-being, and children as a caregiver for a parent with cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hogg.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. So I think we all somewhat inherently know what it means to be a caregiver, but I will give you sort of the official definition from the National Cancer Institute. And that is that a caregiver is any person who gives care to somebody who needs help taking care of themselves. That can be care for children, care for elderly folks, or people with a chronic illness or who are disabled at any age. Caregivers can be health professionals, but for the purpose of today's call, we're going to be talking about caregiving that's completed by family members or friends. Caregivers help with the daily needs of another person, so that can include things like housework, cleaning and cooking, could be managing someone's finances, making or attending medical appointments for them, providing transportation to medical appointments or to grocery shop, or it could just be offering emotional support. The AARP and the National Alliance for Caregiving periodically conduct a Caregiving in the U.S. survey. And I know we have some international people on the call today, so I apologize that this is sort of a U.S. Centric definition or statistic, but I think it's helpful to see how widespread caregiving is. So we know that more people are taking on the role of unpaid caregiver as time goes on, and they're doing so for recipients who may have increasingly complex medical or support needs. The last caregiving in the U.S. survey was done in 2020, and at that time, there were an estimated 51 million Americans who were serving as caregivers. About 7% of those are believed to be children under the age of 18. So this is obviously many millions of children that we know are in this position, and so you would think this would be a topic that researchers would have covered. And there is certainly a plethora of research that addresses the caregiving experience of parents caring for a child with cancer, as well as adult children who are caring for a parent with cancer. But despite recognizing and knowing that children function in caregiving roles for medically complex patients, I was unable to identify any research that addresses the well-being of children in these roles. So I'm just going to talk about what we do know rather than focus on what we don't know. So we certainly know that children are significantly impacted by parental cancer. Studies have found that most children take on extra burdens during a parent's cancer diagnosis and treatment. And again, that's things like household chores and responsibilities for sibling care. It could be medical care for their parent, but there are a lot of different ways that those household burdens fall on them. Children are already at risk for various maladaptive psychosocial, emotional, and behavioral stress responses when their parent has cancer. And these include things like somatic complaints. That's headaches and stomach aches. They have separation anxiety. They endorse being distressed or confused. There's a lot of worry. And from a behavioral standpoint, we see things like increased truancy, so missing more school. Children are often attuned to their parents' stress, and we know that they will internalize or kind of hold on to their own distress in order to protect their parent from any additional burden or having to worry about them. Of course, as a parent, we know that we still worry about our kids, but children will withhold that information and not communicate it necessarily. And so at times, that can result in parents unintentionally minimizing the distress their children are experiencing. The good news is that for many children, this stress response will get better over time, but there is evidence to indicate that some children do remain vulnerable to long-term problems. We know that kids want to be involved in their parents' cancer experience and to help support the family. And there are some really positive outcomes for kids when they're allowed to engage in age-appropriate activities to help out. So some of the benefits include strengthening familial relationships, having a greater appreciation for life, and improvements in their own perceived personal strength and maturity. However, children overall demonstrate improved well-being when normalcy is maintained in the family. So that would include the preservation of parent-child roles and responsibilities. For children's well-being, that would mean implementing consistent routines and continuing normal activities. Children should be encouraged to go to school, spend time with friends, and engage in extracurricular activities and hobbies. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. That was just a wonderful presentation. And because you are the first speaker, you've really set the stage for today's program. So just a sterling presentation. Just I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Andrea Kalvasmaki. And Dr. Kalvasmaki is Research Health Science Specialist, VA Informatics, Decision Enhanced and Analytics Sciences Ideas Center, VA Elizabeth Dole Center of Excellence for Veteran and Caregiver Research, VA Salt Lake City Healthcare System, Research Associate Division of Epidemiology, University of Utah School of Medicine. And Dr. Kalvasmaki will be addressing children as caregivers for a friend, children as caregivers for a grandparent, children as caregivers for an older adult, managing family, friends, and traditions. It is my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kalvasmaki.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate this opportunity. And as I talk, I'd like to also mention that I am a former child caregiver. I was a caregiver for a sibling growing up with complex disabilities, traumatic brain injury, and my mother had thyroid cancer when I was a child, and she has survived and thrived. So I'd like to talk a little bit about friend, grandparent, and older adult. Within the veteran community, we see that children are caregivers for veterans and military family members, but we also have this interwoven network of individuals. And I've been leading a study in Utah that's been working directly with youth caregivers and their families to understand the different roles that young caregivers can play. What's fascinating is that one of the things that the children bring up over and over is that they understand the value of friendship and play. And so there are times when a young caregiver can actually help another sibling or a sibling or another young person, let's say about their same age, coping with some type of complex condition where they can help them play. They can help them feel like a child. They can help them feel like life is normal. Interestingly, very similarly, they do the same thing for a grandparent. One of the young people that's on my community advisory board, she is 12, and she helps support her grandmother with Alzheimer's. Now, to give her grandpa a break, she lived with them full time. She was relinquished to their care, and this is happening more and more across the United States that we see young people actually being raised by grandparents. We call them grand families in Utah. These kids help their grandparents to say, let's sit down, let's play a board game, let's do this game. That time is incredibly valuable for the other caregiver to go to the grocery store, to go take a shower, to take care of their own needs. And not only do they provide that additional time, the child gets a sense of, hey, I'm doing something valuable for my grandparent. The grandparent receiving this kind of care has a moment of respite and joy. We see individuals with Alzheimer's or other complex conditions actually enjoy spending time with a young person who's willing to sit down and play dominoes, for instance. Within this, one of the statistics that are just coming out from within the U.S., and again, this is an emerging area within the U.S. Other countries are more further along in research and policy than we are. But within the last year, we've seen some statistics looking at just Bureau of Labor statistics and other data in which we see that we at least 2 million young people under the age of 18 are providing care for an older adult in the United States for a variety of different condition. The big challenge, and Dr. Hogg presented this, is managing things like family, friends, and traditions. Friendships are hard to maintain when you're a young caregiver. It's hard to be able to do social activities if you are supporting the family and maybe you as an individual are one of the only people able to help with a specific family member who is suffering. So one of the things that I recommend just from my own experience and from these families that I'm working with is for holding traditions, include wherever possible additional people. So having friends or family to expand the circle and provide avenues for inclusivity will help young people to engage in traditions and engage in play during that time and get the socialization that they need. For instance, when my mother was coping with her cancer, I was 15 years old, we decided to host a Christmas dinner at our house that included my older brother and his friends. The older brother and his friends swept in while I was helping with cooking, and the younger sibling, they engaged in games. They got my father to do things that he couldn't do otherwise. And even though we, you know, served my mother her Christmas dinner in bed, the rest of us had a joyous time because it wasn't just restricted to the individuals providing care. So there's ways that you can manage family, friends, and traditions. It's important to talk about that and make a plan that works with families for that.
Wow. Thank you so much, Dr. Kavasmaki. That is so, what a wonderful, wonderful presentation. And how amazing what you said. It will resonate for people on the call in terms of things that they perhaps can do, maybe they hadn't thought of doing, that are now, will be available to them. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Amazing presentation, and both sharing of yourself and also the research and what you're doing as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Nancy Sincotta, and Ms. Sincotta is an oncology social worker. She is Chief Psychosocial Officer, Ritchie Childhood Cancer Foundation, Senior Director of Social Work, Education, and Research, Senior Lecturer at Columbia University School of Social Work, Faculty Zelda Foster Studies Program, NYU School of Social Work, Faculty End of Life Certificate Program, Smith College School of Social Work, Researcher, Consultant, Team Impact Narrative Medicine Practitioner. And Ms. Sincotta will be discussing children as a caregiver to a sibling with cancer into adulthood and beyond. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Sincotta.
So I will be talking about the evolution of caregiver thoughts in siblings of children facing cancer. So my role here is to really keep siblings in the forefront of the thinking when a child has cancer and as that child ages into adulthood. I have known many families dealing with oncology diagnoses over many decades. So in some situations, I have met siblings when they are very young, and I now know them as adults 30 years later facing some of these issues. And there really are some parallels in the early role of being a sibling, and then as you grapple with some of the thoughts that you may be a caregiver for your sibling later on in life. As you experience being the sibling of a child with cancer, initially, there's many different ways that you may react during the course of treatment. Sometimes you really worry, you're jealous about your sibling, and you miss the attention that you get from parents and other family members that you might get less of because you have a sibling in the family with cancer. It can all be very confusing. And clarifying the issues at all ages is really important to help people begin to think about who they are in relationship to their siblings and how their life has changed. Because you think about it at early ages, right, and you think about some developmental concepts. You know, when siblings hear conversations, their language is different, they understand things differently. So you think about, like, they hear that somebody is going to be taking blood from their sibling, right? So depending, if you're four and you hear that, you may wonder, what does that mean, taking blood, all their blood, some of their blood? There was one situation in which we had an eight-year-old who had been worked with by all of the psychosocial professionals was going to be a bone marrow transplant donor and was very upset before the transplant. And the reason the child was upset was because they had heard that, that they were going to need to have their marrow given to their sibling, and the child said they were upset because they didn't have a bow and arrow. So what they heard in their language developmentally wasn't marrow, it was bow and arrow. So it becomes important at all stages for siblings to think about kind of clarifying information and also giving children the opportunity to react to the changes in the family because of cancer. If you think about it, childhood cancer patients have access to health and mental health professionals from the time of diagnosis. Siblings don't have that access in the same way, and they need similar access. You understand that your sibling being sick requires attention related to the illness, but you require attention as well, and you may feel guilty about that. You may feel like you still want the emotional connection that your sibling has in your family. So you can also feel guilty that you're not sick, and some of these feelings will carry over to adulthood. It's important to remember that all that has been written about sibling rivalry was not written about those who face facing cancer. It's a natural part of family development, and it continues throughout the diagnosis. So cancer is a family affair. Early on in the role that you might have as a child with a sibling, there may be some simple age-appropriate caregiving-like responsibilities that you take on, getting water, reading a story, taking over your sibling's chores as part of the family's new illness routine. At certain ages, children may mimic what their parents are doing and begin helping with other caregiving responsibilities. If a sibling is on a road to recovery with limited late effects, this role in these tasks may be short-lived. But the memories of that time will endure may influence the healthy sibling's perception of their sibling in an ongoing way throughout life. So they may, as a result of these early experiences, think of them as ill, potentially as less capable, and may need help adjusting to the new strengths of their sibling as their sibling does better medically. So, and the course of the illness plays a role in the sibling's thinking. So if the feeling is that everything is going to be fine, the patient is going to regain independence and normal development as a child, as a teen, and as a young adult, there'll be less thought of connections to caregiving responsibilities. If a sibling has late effects that are permanent or might be related to an ongoing prolonged illness experience, then the framework for envisioning greater future caregiving responsibilities changes. And should an illness progress, a sibling can be left with feelings that they should have done more or could have done more. So during the illness phase and after, a healthy sibling often becomes the primary friend of the child with cancer and the teen, the young adult with cancer, almost to be thought of as like emotional caregiving, right? But when you're in that role, it can become complicated because the sibling can feel guilty again if they have normal experiences and successes that their sibling with cancer doesn't have. And they may feel guilty that they want those normal achievements, and even if they are achieving more, they may feel certain feelings of remorse towards their sibling. So when you think about some of these things, siblings can carry an intense sense of responsibility for their siblings' well-being. So for families, it's important to anticipate and discuss and plan for the child with cancer's needs as a family and as they age. Some families will feel that they shouldn't bring the burden of this discussion into a dialogue with siblings. But the burden is different than involving them in conversations and activities and having them feel like they are part of the family illness culture. So how families react during a diagnosis on will affect how siblings react in these situations. So it's important to recognize that every sibling is an individual, respecting everyone's involvement at every juncture in this journey and treating cancer as a family affair. So it's not just the child with cancer, not just the siblings. Everybody is impacted. And planning, talking, and seeking professional assistance is really important in addressing the anxieties, the uncertainties, the sadness, and the potential loss of normal independence for the child with cancer. So connecting siblings with other siblings in similar situations, particularly in communities like the brain tumor community, is really important. I think it's also just helpful to recognize that in life, sibling relationships are often the longest relationships we all have. So it is likely at some point, even without a cancer diagnosis in a family, that one sibling may become a caregiver for the other. For the patient diagnosed in childhood with ongoing needs, there's an ongoing emotional and practical journey for siblings, which can impact not only them, but their partners, their careers, and other life decisions. The potential issues for future caregiver burden and managing perceived responsibilities present psychosocial concerns for those impacted by childhood cancer and their impact on healthy development, and that all needs to be considered as we have more children who are surviving into adulthood and many who may be unable to live independently. So not unlike some of the decisions young adults have to make for the caregiving needs of their parents, these decisions are important to think about and to plan for. And so everything that's happening on this panel is really relevant. So who you are as a family, how you cope, and how you manage your family needs, and how you manage past caregiving situations are all relevant here. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Nkata. That was just a wonderful presentation, really highlighting children as caregivers to a sibling with cancer into adulthood and beyond. Just a wonderful presentation. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Amy Clara, and Dr. Clara is a staff psychologist, MGH Cancer Center, co-director of training for the Center for Psychiatric Oncology and Behavioral Sciences, Massachusetts General Hospital, instructor, Harvard Medical School, adjunct associate professor, MGH Institute for Health Professions. And Dr. Clara will be addressing children as caregivers for a young adult, children as caregivers for cancer survivors, care coordination as a child survivor, the long-term effects on children as caregivers. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Clara.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, and I honestly feel so honored to be in such a good company. As I was listening to the other presenters, I was thinking, there's going to be nothing left for me to present because there really is so much overlap. But I guess just starting off with the piece about children as caregivers for young adults, and this, like, that range of age can be really tricky to pin down. Like, sometimes we say it's adolescents, the young adults. Sometimes we talk about the young adult being the parent, but I wanted to more just broadly generalize how we might support those children. And the two biggest things that I talk about with people that I take care of is establishing and maintaining a connection. And this can actually be fairly similar to caregiving for a friend, caregiving for a sibling, really allowing that child who is acting as the caregiver to set the pace as to how they want to connect with that person. A big piece for any caregiver is to really try not to put too much pressure on that person or that child to be a certain way or feel a certain thing. We do see a lot of people feel very pressured. So the establishing and maintaining, how do you want to relate to this person that you're caregiving, this younger adult, that can be really nice just to start the pace at the very beginning. The other piece we always talk about is really acknowledging what that caregiver, the child of the caregiver, might be experiencing. And that can look like normalizing certain emotions. We see people or children especially express confusion, uncertainty. It also changes how they might view that person. So say the child looks up to a young adult, and that young adult might have been this, you know, strong person in a certain way, but maybe treatment changed how they were for a small period of time. You can acknowledge for that child as the caregiver that, you know, how they change their perspective on this person they care about, it can change, but it doesn't mean it's forever. So again, any of that validation, acknowledgement, how do you feel, what are you feeling, how can these things change? Because sometimes we'll hear children get overly concrete, and that is okay. But we want to make sure we're acknowledging that and having it spoken out loud. Another big piece we talk about is how much time. And again, going back to my point about a lot of caregivers, both children and adults, they're really pressured to be a certain way, do a certain thing, expend a certain amount of time to be with that person. And with younger adults, they might actually be fairly okay. But if a child wants to caregive and spend time with that younger adult, ask the younger adult to be clear. How much time are you willing to spend with this person, with this child? What does quality time look like together? And it could be as simple as watching a favorite YouTube video together, or if they have a shared show they really enjoy, have it planned out, set the expectation, and that way people have expectations to meet, and when they're met, people feel good, but they don't feel like they have to do more than that. We also talk about any involvement in physical care being something that is meaning-making for the child. It can be as simple as getting them a glass of water, getting them a pillow, or sitting with the person. This might not look like being with them during a treatment appointment, but it could be something that's more leisurely on the weekend, just sitting with them while they're waiting for the mail to come. Something very simple but meaningful for both parties. Going on to more of caregiving for cancer survivors, and I know that word, we're ever evolving that. We have our survivors, we have our metavivors in the world today. The big piece that we talk about, again, I keep saying the word acknowledging, but acknowledging that transition from active treatment to survivorship, making it a very explicit conversation can be really helpful for anyone, children who are caregivers, to be aware of what's the timeline here. And what does survivorship look like? What does survivorship feel like? That actually means so many different things to so many different people. And so the person who is supporting that cancer, that person who's gone through treatment, it can be really tricky to say, well, how often can I ask them? When can I bring it up? When can I talk about this? So sometimes I give some very concrete time check-in points. I say 6 months post active treatment end, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. Those are obviously just very overly concrete. It does not have to be that rigid. But I think some people, especially if it is a child as a caregiver, it feels good to have kind of a reminder for themselves as opposed to having it constantly on their mind as if they have to do something soon. You know, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years ongoing as check-in points, because in survivorship, a lot of folks will talk about, oh, everyone thinks I'm okay now that I'm out of active treatment. But as a psychologist who takes care of both patients and caregivers and family, we know that's not true. There is a huge long-ending tail to how do I recover from this process? And then another thing as someone looking out on the outside, looking in, talking about children as caregivers to folks who are survivors of treatment, we like to just remind people there's a huge amount of burnout in caregivers. So really reminding people to reset, check back in with themselves, building up self-compassion, that really to listen to yourself if you're being a version of yourself. Maybe you're more grumpy, maybe you're not eating the healthiest. Again, this goes for both kids and adults. But that look at the signs of what that you're not okay. And if you're not okay, what's the reset button? What does that look like for you? Is it a day? Is it an hour? Is it asking for different support, different help? Again, this is all about normalizing for kids and children of caregivers because they don't know otherwise. This is something that we emphasize a lot, is that this is a brand new skill that when caregivers step into the picture, no matter the age, this is a brand new skill that everyone is learning. So really to normalize that and saying, this is something new to you. Don't expect yourself to know how to do this perfectly. One little point I just wanted to bring up here, this is something that I always say, like, oh, make sure you're empathetic, make sure you're self-compassionate. If people struggle with knowing what does empathy look like, what does compassion look like to give back to either survivors or patients in active treatment, I strongly recommend Brené Brown video on empathy. It's a good way just to let people know, like, this is how I want you to be with me. And again, it's a very big visual, it's a cartoon. So it is applicable for both children and adults. So I would recommend that as just a resource to take a peek at. And then last but not least, I'm trying to be conscientious about time, so please forgive me, but care coordination for the child caregiver, the long-term effects on children as caregivers. I want to take the pressure off from anyone who's listening that this does not have to be a make it or break it moment, and this can both be for children all the way up to adults, because what we see is that this can be the most challenging but also the most rewarding time of people's lives. So what we see in the long-term effect is honestly like immense self-personal growth, strength and resiliency that children never knew they had is either planted for the first time or it's grown out of that experience of being a caregiver. And we call some of this post-traumatic growth. It's a positive psychological growth after enduring something that's really difficult. And even if we as adults use a specific type of semantics and language, kids can feel it. Kids know that something difficult has happened to me, or if this child caregiver is an adolescent, they know what feels different about them. This is about encouraging them to take this experience and make some kind of meaning out of it. I think I'll end there just for time's sake, but again, just promotion of meaning making is huge, and burnout is what we'd like to keep an eye on, and really when we see that in other people, to encourage them to take care of themselves. So thank you so much for your time, everyone.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Clara. That was just a wonderful presentation. That video sounds like a terrific video. We're going to email you afterwards to get the actual link for us so we can be sure to make that available to everybody to see as well. Just thank you so much. This is a superb presentation. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Nikki Malafitis. She's an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. She's a New Jersey program coordinator at Cancer Care, and she'll be talking about practical tips for managing children's caregiver stress. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Malafitis.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mesner, for having me, and thank you everyone for being here today. So as mentioned, I will be sharing on the practical tips for managing caregiver stress in children. Whether they are caring for a friend, a parent, grandparent, or sibling, children oftentimes carry this invisible burden. So there's a variety of tips surrounding this topic, but today we're going to focus on about six of them. So first and foremost, validating and normalizing their emotions. Children may feel guilt, they might feel frustration, resentment. Everyone is different, but letting them know that it's okay to feel this way, normalizing it for them. It might be helpful to set up consistent times each day to discuss the child's feeling and allow them a space to just ask any questions they have and express themselves. Oftentimes, when discussing the diagnosis of the child, depending on what you feel comfortable with, it might be helpful to also utilize simple terms about the diagnosis while also utilizing the word cancer. Another tip that might be helpful is to help maintain routines and structures while also including breaks and fun activities. Structure allows children a sense of control, and when taking on the role of caregiving, there's a lot outside of everyone's control. So depending on their age, you know, providing them the time to play or read, maybe engage in sports or, you know, do their musicals if they have that interest in that, spending time with friends and so on, but giving them this space to feel like a kid, even if it is for just 20 minutes. Along with maintaining structure and routine, it could also be really helpful to educate children on setting boundaries. You know, as adults or young adults, we hear setting boundaries a lot, but this can also be really helpful for children. You know, allow them to know that, yes, it's okay to say yes, but it's also okay to say no. You know, they need to prioritize themselves as well and do what makes them feel good. Another key point is encouraging open communication. So identifying the caregiver responsibilities that are age appropriate and allow the child that choice or that option to determine the responsibilities that they would like to partake in. Again, it gives them that sense of control. You may want to ask them what they want to know or maybe what they don't want to know. A lot of times they may have a lot of interest and oftentimes they may not want to hear anything, and that's okay. You also may want to ask them what they want to be involved in with their loved one's care. You know, do they want to be at medical appointments? Do they want to, you know, hear what the doctors had said, anything along those lines? Or they may not want to be involved at all. And again, that's okay. But it's having that open communication. Being open and honest with each other can go a long way. Nowadays, kids know more than ever before, you know, with social media and, you know, access to internet and research, they can find out a lot more of information than never before. So just utilizing that open and honest communication can go a long way. We also just want to ensure that they have consistent emotional and social support. This looks different for everybody, whether they're a child, young adult, adult, but, you know, having that emotional and social support can go a long way. So this might mean one-on-one counseling where they're meeting with, whether it's an oncology social worker, a psychologist, anybody like that, just to have that one-on-one space. They may connect with like a trusted mentor, you know, someone who they look up to, or maybe someone who's been in this position before. Maybe it's peer matching. They also may be able to engage with a school staff member, just someone who checks in with them regularly, you know, asks them how they're doing, acknowledges, you know, I understand what you're going through, but we're here for you. This allows them a space to identify healthy ways to express themselves, but also identify those healthy coping skills, whether it means taking time to themselves, utilizing drawing, listening to music, going for a walk, you know, those different types of coping skills that we all use every day. And then also there's support groups for young caregivers. This can be a great outlet because it's a reminder that they aren't alone and there are others in this situation who could support them. And then lastly, educating the adults around them. So you may want to inform teachers, coaches, even extended family members about their caregiving experience or, you know, the situation that they are involved in and what their role might look like. This allows others to be mindful of any changes that might be taking place for that child, whether it's a behavioral change or a social change, an emotional change. You know, the adults that are aware of this can be able to provide them support and address it in an appropriate way because they have that knowledge on it. But again, this is always up to everybody's comfortability because everybody's story is different and it's still what works best for you. And so in closing, you know, just wanted to recognize that children who take on caregiving roles, they show extraordinary resilience. It is not an easy task, but offering that emotional validation, the balanced routines, age-appropriate roles, and strong support can have a really positive impact on both their health and well-being. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you so much, Ms. Malfitas. That was just a superb presentation, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Haley Fuchs, and Ms. Fuchs is an oncology social worker. She's a young adult program coordinator at Cancer Care, and she'll be discussing coping with birthdays, holidays, and special occasions, Cancer Care's free national programs and services, and she'll give information about how to contact Cancer Care via our Hopeline and website. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Fuchs.
Hi, everyone, and thank you, Dr. Messner. My name is Haley, and like Dr. Messner mentioned, I'm going to touch briefly on coping with birthdays, holidays, and special occasions for young caregivers, and then talk about Cancer Care's programs and how we can support children who are caring for a loved one. So as we've heard from our panelists, there are many challenges that children who are caregivers may face. But one challenge that could be paramount is navigating birthdays, holidays, and special occasions. These moments are often filled with joy and celebration, but for a young caregiver, they could take on a very different tone, especially when a loved one is seriously ill and going through cancer treatment. Children could feel a mix of emotions, maybe guilt for wanting to celebrate, perhaps sadness that things aren't the same as they were before their loved one was sick, and maybe even anger or confusion. And it's really important for the adults surrounding the child to help normalize these feelings and create space for kids to express them. One helpful strategy is to prepare ahead of time. So talking openly about what the holiday or special day might look like and acknowledge that it might be different this year. Asking the child maybe what traditions they'd like to keep or what, if anything, they'd like to change or simplify. Additionally, flexibility is definitely key. So for some families, maybe scaling back to smaller, quieter gatherings could be helpful and necessary. For others, maybe finding creative ways to include the loved one, whether that's in person, virtually, or symbolically, could be very meaningful to the child as well. And then additionally, we want to encourage children to honor their own needs. If they want to celebrate with friends or take a break from caregiving for an afternoon, that's totally okay. These moments can actually help refill their emotional cup. And so kind of in short, special occasions can be very complex for caregiving kids, but giving children some control and planning, granting them permission to adapt traditions and supporting them in processing the feelings that could come up can help maintain those moments of connection and meaning, especially around holidays and special occasions. And now, just for time's sake, I want to shift gears a bit, provide a brief review of cancer care in our services and how cancer care can support children and their families. So Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization which provides free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of a cancer diagnosis. I'm going to provide a very brief review of our services. So a cancer diagnosis can be very overwhelming, as we've mentioned in this presentation, and additional support and guidance may help to relieve feelings of anxiety. So working one-on-one with an oncology social worker through individual counseling could offer a space to express one's feelings, emotions, and concerns. And Cancer Care does offer free cancer-focused counseling to individuals impacted by cancer for those who live in New York and New Jersey, both for children and adults. Joining a support group could also be a way of getting additional support through this time. So being a member in a support group can offer the opportunity to speak with others, gather and provide support, as well as obtain information. Cancer Care offers online support groups nationwide, and these groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by oncology social workers. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and you can register through our website. And those diagnosed with cancer could experience practical and financial concerns throughout their treatment. So it could be helpful to discuss any financial concerns with your medical providers, with your social worker, with a patient navigator, as well as the financial department at the treatment center to see if there are any financial options available. Cancer Care also does offer some limited financial assistance to those who qualify. Cancer Care also provides free telephone resource navigation to those living with cancer, those who are post-treatment, and to caregivers as well. These services are provided by professional resource navigators and oncology social workers and are available in English and Spanish. Resource navigation really centers on the practical challenges that arise from a cancer diagnosis, and staff can provide clients with resources, referrals, and potential financial assistance options. And finally, on Cancer Care's website, there is also a wide array of reading material and information related to children who are caregiving for a diagnosed loved one. This includes recorded Connect education workshops, Cancer Care Out Loud, the Cancer Care podcast, and multiple publications, as well as stories of help and hope in both general and specific resources. And for children specifically, we have a back-to-school program where we provide backpacks with school supplies to kids who are going through treatment, as well as those who are caregivers and those who are bereaved. We also have had a gift card program around the holidays for those impacted by cancer, as well as our winter warmth program, which provides coats and other winter gear for children impacted by cancer diagnosis. And if you're interested in learning more about Cancer Care Supportive Services, I encourage you to explore the website and, of course, call Cancer Care's National Hope Line at 800-813-4673 to speak to one of our oncology social workers. Thank you so much for your attention and the opportunity to speak on this program. And I'll now turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Hughes. That was just a wonderful presentation and lots of resources for our participants. We'll be sending all of you any of the links, any information that we've offered during the program, and then some, because you'll be getting a SurveyMonkey, which evaluates the program, but you'll also be getting in that survey evaluation, there'll be lots of other resources that you can access. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Rob to explain to our participants how to queue up and ask questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Rob?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this question is, this is Dr. Clara. I think going to counseling or a support group might be good for my older brother. He's been having a difficult time after being diagnosed with lymphoma. We haven't spoken about it yet because I'm afraid it will upset him. Is this something I should bring up or wait? Could you address this, Dr. Clara?
Yeah, sorry, for my clarity, is the person asking the caregiver of her brother?
I'm sorry?
Is that correct? Is the person asking the caregiver to her older brother and thinks her older brother should go to support group?
Older brother, yes, it's for the older brother, yes.
Okay, so if the question is how do you encourage someone that we love to seek mental health support or general peer-to-peer support, that's a really tricky one because we might think that someone could benefit from it and they might actually really benefit from it, but until that person is ready to access support themselves, it's unlikely that they will. We really don't want to encourage using guilt or any kind of manipulative effects in that sense of, hey, you know, like you really need to go, or, you know, all patients who do well do go access support. We don't want to do that, but sometimes we do encourage, if you are the caregiver, you are the loved one, and you think, oh, my older brother would really benefit from going to either a therapist or to a support group, you can just start to reflect to them, again, very gently, it seems like you haven't been yourself lately. It seems like you haven't been sleeping lately. Did you know there are people who can help with that? And it doesn't have to be the Hollywood version of therapy. It doesn't have to be the Hollywood version of group support. These are trained, kind, usually nice people who already expect patients to show up or expect caregivers to show up, and they're there when you're ready. So the reflection is of the behavior you worry about, and then just the offer is, you know, these services are there not because only a few people need them, but we do expect people to come, but not everyone accesses them. So kind of normalizing, what does it mean to seek care?
Excellent, thank you. And another question for Dr. Kavosmaki. How can I better mediate communication as a caregiver between my loved one and his healthcare team? I often have to step in and help my dad communicate with his healthcare team because of his forgetfulness and brain fog. But I end up missing things if I can't make it to an appointment.
Thank you. That's a great question. And I'm hopeful this is a young caregiver asking this question, and hopefully my answer is helpful for other people with young caregivers. Doctors are slowly becoming more aware of the caregiving team, including younger members. The first thing I would do is suggest that you ask your father to let his care team know that you are his caregiver and you need that information as well. And ask the doctor to take your information so that they can convey it to you. Some hospital systems will allow the ability to add you to a MyChart, for instance, or to add you to a text line so that they can communicate to you as well as to your parent who is receiving the care. If you have any trouble with that, reach out to Cancer Care and they can give you some materials. I can send some articles or different organizations that are starting to raise awareness of young caregivers here in the United States that have some advocacy tips for how to advocate for yourself as a young caregiver.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And someone's asked the question, is this presentation recorded and will it be available for distribution? So this program is available live, but then it's also available as a podcast for a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it'll be up for at least a year, if not longer. So just give it about a week or 10 days and we'll have it up. It also will have closed caption on it as well. So it'll have that addition. So they also a question for Dr. Hode. You mentioned resilience. Are there notable studies showing the effects of cancer caregiving on child development?
There are. I think as I mentioned, and I think as some of the other speakers mentioned, children are incredibly resilient, and the vast majority of children rebound from some of these stressors that they are going to face. We know that there are benefits to caregiving, and that includes to some of their development. There are things like feeling like a natural leader, knowing how to be a good and empathic friend. So there are definitely developmental milestones that are being met as kids go through some of these stresses. I think the challenge is always that balance of making sure that we are recognizing that there are some benefits of helping out and supporting a parent who's going through cancer at the same time that we're also protecting children from unnecessary amounts of distress or stress. So again, that's kind of where that idea of maintaining normalcy, making sure that they have somebody to talk to, making sure that we are checking in with children and asking them how involved they want to be. Those are all things that I think can help us to help kids to benefit from the caregiving without undue distress.
Excellent. I'm going to ask our speakers just to give about a less than a minute takeaway that you'd like people to take away from the program. I'm going to start with Dr. Hode.
Well, this has been really a wonderful presentation. I'm really excited to be a part of this. As somebody who works with kids who are going through cancer treatment all the time, a lot of these topics resonated with me. I definitely see the family impact, and I'm just so grateful that so many people are on this call and are receiving this information. Having this knowledge is the first step in being able to make really great supportive decisions for children.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Kalvasmaki?
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I am an advocate for youth caregivers, and I'm so happy to have an opportunity to speak as a former youth caregiver myself and as a researcher in youth caregiving, and I encourage others to continue working towards understanding and empathy in this area. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Clara?
I think my one takeaway point would just be in any one of us to role model for younger people and children that they don't need to be perfect, they don't need to know what they're doing, but it's okay to learn along the way.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Ms. Malafitis?
My takeaway was that having that self-compassion, not only for yourself, but also for the children, and knowing that there are various supports out there, and just seeing how to access them for yourselves.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ms. Fuchs?
Yeah, I would say my takeaway for children who are caregiving and for those around them is that reaching out for support can be really scary, but it can be, you know, so important and so helpful because, you know, there are supports out there, especially, you know, we have support at Cancer Care and there's so many other organizations that provide, you know, groups, counseling, you know, other ways for these young caregivers to feel connected while they're going through something really difficult.
Thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've just been phenomenal. I have to say that this is the first time we've offered this program, and this program was supported by ISI Inc. and Pfizer, and I really want to thank them for supporting this amazing program, and that we will hope to do more programs like this because there's a great need for it, and we certainly have expert speakers to address this topic. For those of you who had an opportunity to ask a question, please take your question back to your treating healthcare team. That's really important, or to the colleagues that you can get information from. And for those of you who didn't have a chance to ask a question, again, take your question to the team that you're working with to see if they can further help you with your questions. Most importantly, I just want to thank everyone for really participating in today's program. It was the first time we've offered it, but not the last. And we are delighted with the response to the program, both in the United States and internationally. And we will definitely be offering more programs like this. And again, I want to thank our speakers, our participants who've been phenomenal in terms of asking such great questions, and all of you. And I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.